This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm.
Today's show is presented by DaVinci Smart Drink. Order yours now at lineupmedia.fm/DaVinci. DaVinci, excite better thinking.
You need a mental boost? DaVinci Smart Drinks were designed with professional thinkers in mind. With key ingredients shown to improve cognitive function and increase mental energy, DaVinci Smart Drinks excite better thinking. Drink a DaVinci. Let it go to your head.
You're listening to This Day in History, a podcast dedicated to examining history from a standpoint of determining which event on any given day had the greatest impact on our lives. Now your host, Tony Hubert and Armand Kachigian.
This Day in History, part of lineupmedia.fm, is back with you. The January 9th edition is here, and we're brought to you by audible.com and by amazon.com. Tony Hubert here with you, my partner, Armand Kachigian, as we bring you January 9th, the events that happened, the big events that shaped the world that you live in today, plus who was born, who died, and, of course, Armand's own sense of humor and political ramblings.
Redoubtable.
Okay, let's get right into it today. And as always, speaking of Amazon and Audible, Armand, when we have book recommendations, film recommendations.
I just got a good book on Amazon, Public Enemies, I'm reading.
By Brian Burrell.
I'm not sure who the author might be.
It's by Brian Burrell.
Well, the birth of the FBI.
Yes, I read it many years ago.
Okay, great.
And it's what the movie Public Enemies is based on. They take the Dillinger
out of the book.
Of course, the film did, but
my favorite Dillinger was the one with Warren Oates.
Warren Oates.
1973.
Okay. What's the film? Dillinger. Just Dillinger?
Yes.
Man, I don't remember that.
Richard Dreyfuss was Babyface Nelson.
Oh, my.
Yeah. And
it's fresh off of American Graffiti to playing Babyface
It was either right there.
Nelson.
It might have been even before that. I'm not sure. And then he,
I love it.
Ben Johnson was Melvin Purvis.
Oh, yeah. The agent, Melvin Purvis.
Melvin Purvis.
Yeah. Good agent.
Good stuff.
All right. Here we go. Again, there's your first recommendation of the day.
Yes.
Public Enemies by Brian Burrell. Also wrote Barbarians at the Gate.
Oh, yeah. Good book. I've read that one.
Mm-hmm. All right. 1431, the judges investigating the trial of Joan of Arc in Rouen, France.
Rouen. I've seen this place.
Have you been to the cathedral in Rouen?
Yeah. She was beautiful. Burned at the stake and everything. Yeah. She wanted to see the cross in front of her.
This is the seat.
We talked about her.
Of the English occupation government at the time, 1431. This is where Joan of Arc, the trial begins, and it's where she ends.
Yeah.
And that all happened on this date, the 9th.
But it was a turning point in the Hundred Years' War, which was
107 years.
116.
116 years,
okay,
just like I said.
Drill that into you.
The date, 1493, the first sighting. I love this, Armand. The first sighting of manatees.
Yeah, this is very significant.
By Christopher Columbus. Now, let's scratch this part here for a second.
Scratch your part, I'll scratch mine.
That'd be fine. Christopher Columbus didn't sight any manatees.
Okay, I wouldn't think.
Here's my problem with Columbus as I get older and older. He wasn't the first guy to see the New World. We all know someone else was here before. But he wasn't even the first guy on his voyage to see the New World.
That's true, too.
Like, he's the guy up on top yelling.
Yeah, but he's the captain.
I don't give a crap.
I want to know
the name of the guy who first set eyes from that.
He took Isabel to bed, so he gets Isabella.
Why doesn't that guy way up there in the bird's nest?
Because the guy in charge gets the credit.
That's a load of
crap. That's life.
So I want to know who really saw the first manatee. It wasn't Chris Columbus. He's probably asleep.
All right.
1768, Philip Astley on January 9th stages what everyone considers the first modern circus in London. And you know what that means, Armand?
Not Rick Astley.
Not Rick.
Okay.
Never going to get. Can you sing that?
No, but I
have you ever been Rickrolled?
No, what is that?
Rick rolling is when you click on something and it's like, oh, I really want to see this. And then all of a sudden, about 3-4 seconds into the video, Rick Astley pops up with that song.
Oh.
That's Rick rolled. You've been Rick rolled.
I guess, yeah.
Anyway, I bring Astley up the first modern circus in London. So 1768, it's fair. I have a hard time believing what's modern. That's I don't understand. What's modern? Romans basically had circuses. They had all sorts of performances.
You're quarreling quite a bit.
I am, because they're full of it in these first two things here. Two out of the first 3 years. First of all, that probably for a modern circus, it's got to be clowns, right? We got to have clowns.
Not necessarily.
How can you say that there weren't clowns?
Well, I don't know if that's what legitimizes a circus. That's all I'm saying.
I think three things.
Trapeze is more.
Elephants, four things.
Trapeze.
Five things we need for a modern circus. Clowns. The ring.
Sawdust.
The ringleader. Elephants. A trapeze artist, definitely. Whatever the name of the girl that rides on, you know, the top of the horse.
All right.
And what's the other one? Oh, yeah. Whoever will.
A juggler.
You can get that at a carnival. Okay. See, carnival and a circus, two different things, aren't they?
All right.
Whoever sticks their head in the lion's mouth. If all those things happen.
Therefore, we must have a lion.
Right.
All right. And a stool and a whip.
That'd be fine.
All right. Back then, probably a little bear baiting.
And if all that happened on January the 9th, 1768, I'll concede Philip Astley had the first modern circus.
All right.
If not, he's a con man.
Will you concede that Christopher Columbus was the first to see a manatee?
No.
All right.
No, because there's no chance he was.
You're a hard man.
I want to know the guy's name. That's all I want. He's
intractable.
Deserves some credit. 1788. Congratulations, Connecticut. You're state number 5.
Thank you.
1793. Jean-Pierre Blanchard becomes the first person to fly a balloon in the United States.
In a balloon.
Yeah, that's the dumbest sentence I've ever read.
Well, it's fly in a balloon. That's
okay. Great.
All right, Montgolfier brothers and all that.
Yeah,
inspiration.
Yeah, yeah. So you get.
Now I'm assuming you skip the next one. One of my big
This
ones.
Is what we call a teaser in the business, Armand. 1799. We will revisit after the birthdays because Armand and I are probably going to be 3 days in a row, 4 days perhaps, of agreeing on the thing.
Oh, no, I was hoping you would. Okay.
That most affects the world we live in today. Opinion. Well, I'm going to try to put up a counter-argument, so we'll come back to that. 1806, Horatio Nelson, the Admiral, the Lord. He receives a state funeral and is interned in St. Paul's Cathedral. Why not Westminster Abbey?
I don't know.
Catholic? That's why St. Paul's?
That's for poets. And,
okay.
But I think they brought him back from Trafalgar and vinegar, I believe, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he'd already lost an arm, an eye.
Can you imagine winning a battle like that and not really getting to enjoy the fruits of it?
The good news and the bad news.
Yeah, we got, poor guy. Again, he's got a nice.
I think the French commander lived.
He's got a nice column there in the square.
Villeneuve.
1839, help me with the pronunciation. The French Academy of Sciences announced.
The daguerreotype.
The daguerreotype
named
photography
after its inventor,
process.
Louis Daguerre.
So the French Academy of Science, on this date, the 9th of January, they announce that this process is now, it's a process. So sometime before that, Louis Daguerre figures out how to take the first photograph.
Pictures, yep.
In fact,
they're called daguerreotypes.
Does the first photograph still exist? Isn't it just a street scene in Paris, 1838?
They got some of his originals.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they do.
1858, Anson Jones. Who is that, you might ask?
Yeah, even I
He's
didn't
a
know
president.
This.
He was a president in the United States. Well, close. He committed suicide. You ever hear of a president committing suicide?
Yes, Getulio Vargas of Brazil.
Of Brazil?
Yes.
Very good. I had no clue.
1954.
So Anson Jones, he was the last president of the Republic of Texas, which, if Armand gets his way, will be a republic soon.
If they want to be a republic,
soon
they
again.
Certainly have the right to do it. That's all I say.
1861.
All right.
This is for you.
This is a fraud. Okay.
And this is a fraud. I agree.
This is Mr. Lincoln at work.
Is this akin to the Gulf of Tonkin incident?
that's a pretty good. Okay. That's a reasonably good comparison.
Almost 100 years apart.
Although, they did fire at the. Okay, go ahead, say what it is.
Yeah, so it's the American Civil War, 1861, January 9th. So, as you can tell, January 9th, 1861, the Civil War is not really underway yet.
But
Star of the West incident occurs near Charleston, South Carolina.
Star of the West is a ship that came into Charleston Harbor ostensibly to feed the poor starving men of Fort Sumter, which is a lot of bullshit. the commander, I think his name was a cap major, Major Anderson. They were doing fine. In fact, the citizens of Charleston were feeding them.
Yeah.
They had all kinds. He even told Lincoln he had enough food for a year. But
now we got to feed them. We got to feed them.
Right. They're starving. Let's get the ship in here. Hopefully somebody is going to take a shot at them, which they did.
Yeah, they did.
Took some pot shots at them, made minimal damage. This, of course, enrages people. But, of course, what they're really enraged about is Charleston Harbor and their 10% tariff as opposed to 40% in Boston and the other northern ports.
Never start a price war against the North.
Yeah, that's why they invade you. So, yeah, you go ahead and be a republic and have slaves, but just don't cut your tariff. That's intolerable. Thank you, Mr. Lincoln.
There you have it. There's
and
Armand.
His
governmental economic thought of the day. Same date. On this very same date, Mississippi becomes the second state to secede from the Union.
Good for them.
Mississippi. They're never first in anything. Not even the Southeastern Conference.
They're last, though, in a couple things.
Yeah, they certainly
are. But nice state. I've driven through
it. It is a beautiful state.
Yeah.
It really is.
What's wrong with Mississippi? Nothing.
No, a lot. It's got the worst public education system in the country. I mean, you can go on and on.
Well, I don't know about that.
I mean, some of the worst laws restricting your rights have been made in the state of Mississippi.
Not my rights.
Yeah, okay. Well, wait till you need to go and sue someone for punitive damages.
Yeah.
Make sure you don't do it in Mississippi.
Okay. I won't get punted.
1894, New England, the Telephone and Telegraph Company
inclusion here.
Of New England installs the first battery-operated telephone switchboard in Lexington, Mass.
That's momentous.
Well, no, the switchboard now call a lot quicker. That's something. Now, you know me in communication. Anything that advances communication generally goes way up on my list. 1909.
I'm against communication. Yeah. Keep your mouth shut. Mind your own business.
Now, you're going to love this one. Right. I have some background for you on this
okay.
one. 1909. Ernest Shackleton.
Oh, I like this
you
guy.
Love him.
I've read a couple books about this guy.
And there's a lot of literature.
This guy had balls, let me tell you. He might have frozen them off, but yeah. He had them.
There's a lot of literature about Shackleton explorations, polar explorations,
well, the discovery
Antarctic.
Is a big one.
There really is. There's great.
He was kind of a dope, really.
There's another name for him. So he leads an expedition to the South Pole. He plants the British flag 97 nautical miles from the South Pole. And at that point, 1909, January the 9th, that's the furthest anyone has ever gotten.
What the hell he stopped for?
Well, I don't know. But the expedition is called the Nimrod Expedition.
All right. Now, though the connotation of that is dumb shit, it's not.
Hold on. Hold on.
Nimrod is a hunter in the Bible.
Oh, not just a hunter, Armand. Not just a hunter.
He also established, I believe, is it the first city in the Old Testament? Which was called Enoch, I believe. Anyway, this Shackleton, several years before... he went on one of the first expeditions with Scott, Robert Falcon Scott, who was the first Englishman, second group to reach. Amundsen reached the pole in, I think, the end of 1919, the same year.
Mm-hmm. No, 1909.
1909, yeah, 1909. And 1910, just like a month later, Scott reaches the South Pole. Amundsen makes it back. Scott doesn't.
We've gone over him.
Robert Falcon Scott.
All right. So.
But these guys, Shackleton and Scott didn't like each other. They went on an expedition together. And apparently Shackleton was kind of a pussy. And Scott basically said, he sent him home. And he said, for his health. He said, you either go home sick or you go home in disgrace because you're kind of a puss.
Oh.
So get the hell out of my tent.
So the Nimrod Expedition.
Yes. That was a different expedition. We're not talking about this.
I know. So the word Nimrod.
Yes.
It's a biblical term.
Right, the hunter.
And it is used to describe a mighty hunter.
Right.
Okay.
Nimrod, the mighty hunter.
In American English.
Oh, okay. Well.
This term has now become a derogatory term.
Correct.
Here is the source of the derogatory term.
Oh, good.
Are you ready?
Yeah, let's have it.
It's going to knock you off your side. I'm telling you, it's going to blow you away.
This should be interesting.
Here is who is credited with the term Nimrod. Being derogatory. Oh, you're close.
Ooh, okay.
Bugs Bunny.
Bugs, huh? Really?
He says this to Elmer Fudd in a 1940 Bugs Bunny cartoon. So that's an early one.
I don't think he'd even be Bugs Bunny then.
He might
not.
He just might be the hair.
Right. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I don't know if they have
might be the. I think that's the first one. What is it? Lonesome Hair or something like that?
Well, and it's the one where Elmer does not look like Elmer.
Right, right.
He's the big fat Elmer.
He's not even Bugs Bunny and
they're
not Elmer yet. Yeah.
Bugs does not look like the traditional Bugs. But in that cartoon, he refers to Elmer as a poor little Nimrod.
Yeah.
Which, if you think about it, the writers, and I don't know if that was a Chuck Jones, but it's certainly a Warner cartoon. They might have been trying to say, oh, he looks, because Elmer's hunting.
Yeah.
He's a poor little hunter.
Exactly.
But because Bugs is just having a go at Elmer all the time, Nimrod becomes the derogatory term.
Well, since we're going to that, I mean, do you know the origin of the word gay?
Oh, gay was happy for years and years and
until
years.
Until supposedly bringing up baby.
What, 1938?
Yeah. Cary Grant is
In Hepburn?
Yeah, Cary Grant's he got his clothes wet, and he's wearing Hepburn's, under things, and her robe, or whatever.
Now, is this before the back of her dress falls off, or?
Yeah, this is after.
They're
up in Connecticut now.
Okay.
With the leopard and everything.
Yep.
So anyway, somehow his clothes got screwed up.
The leopard and everything.
Yeah, baby. Asta, our favorite dog.
Yes.
Asta was in the movie. So he's wearing her robe, and somehow her aunt shows up unexpectedly. He says, what are you doing in those clothes? I'm feeling gay! That's apparently the origin of that word being used in that connotation.
The fact that Bugs Bunny gets credit for changing the meaning of a word warms my heart to no end.
Yeah, because now we call you a Nimrod. You're a dipshit.
Right. Dunce, doofus, dork. Go on
In fact,
on
remember
on.
Pulp Fiction? You give that Nimrod at $1,500.
That's cited in one of these.
Yeah, that's a great
scene. In all the stories about
he's pointing the gun at, what's her name? Yeah.
I can't remember. It's Tim Roth's girlfriend in the diner scene.
Yeah, it's one of her sister and everything.
Honey Bunny.
Yeah, yeah. That's Yolanda. Be cool. Be cool, Yolanda.
We are. Okay, 1916, the Battle of Gallipoli. It concludes, Ottoman Empire victory when the last Allied.
I'm taking shots at Winston. I get Winston and Abe today.
Yeah, you do. The last Allied forces are evacuated from the peninsula, and probably also on that day, Churchill is evacuated from the Admiralty.
It's about time,
1947, the last known. This is a good one. I'm going to give you some floor space here.
I didn't really prepare for this one.
This is good stuff.
Yeah, this is a great. The Black Dahlia case.
The last known sighting of Betty Short while alive occurs on the 9th of January, 1947.
And Betty Short in one piece because they found her cut in half.
In multiple. Yeah.
So anyway, that's the famous Black Dahlia case. Named from she got that name from the Blue Dahlia, Dashiell Hammett novel, which was made into a film with Alan Ladd and the Peekaboo Girl, Veronica Lake. Never did find the murder of this woman, but she was, and it just became kind of symbolic of Los Angeles, where you go out there to be an actress, you wind up chopped up.
And it's the height of film noir.
Or you jump off the H,
of
the Hollywood sign because you can't make it. Yeah.
And it is just the height of film noir at this point, right?
Yes.
And it plays into the whole mystique of
Raymond Chandler's,
Raymond Dash. Who else were the other crime writers?
Well, those are the big ones. James M. Cain was a big one.
That was Postman Always Rings Twice.
That's correct. Black Mask was the magazine they all wrote for.
Okay.
So if you get those Black
Masks. Oh, they had Crime Mags. They're those True Crime Mags.
True Crime. And all. The Black Mask was the first.
Okay. Oh,
so, if you like Pulp Fiction, man, go to Amazon, go to Audible. Oh, man, get your fill of Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, no doubt about
it. Here we go again, Pulp Fiction.
I know. It's a good one. 1960, I just want to mention this because it sounds cool. The president of Egypt, Abdel Nasser.
Gamal Abdel Nasser.
Boy,
what a funeral they gave that guy. Like a million and a half people were there.
Well, he opens construction on the Aswan Dam. How come they don't call it the Aswan High Dam?
Yeah, that's right. That's correct.
It's the Aswan High Dam.
Maybe it wasn't quite so high then.
Well, so he does so by detonating 10 tons of dynamite to demolish 20 tons of granite on the east bank of the Nile.
Yeah, there's a picture of him.
I am all for those. I love watching that stuff.
You like blowing things up?
I love blowing them up good. That's when you say your little line, they blew them up.
Yeah, they blow that up good.
Yeah, I love it.
Speaking of which, since we're going on that subject, one of my biggies for today, which I'll just give you already because it has something to do intimately with that, is 1957, Anthony Eden, the Prime Minister of England, resigns over the Suez Canal crisis.
Yeah.
In 1956, apparently, the Nasser was getting a little too cozy with the Russians. And the British and the French and the Israelis invade Egypt. They've had enough of this shit because they're worried about the Suez Canal. Mm-hmm. So old Gamel sinks a couple of ships right there in the canal, so they can't use it. And Eisenhower doesn't like this very much, puts a lot of pressure, starts selling British sterling, devaluing it. And Eden says, okay, we'll get the hell out, you know, because he told him to leave. But until they started devaluing his currency, he didn't do anything. So he left. And then, of course, he was chastened. And immediately everybody's calling for his resignation, which he did. Anthony Eden resigns 1957 on this date.
So there's a couple books.
The reason Nasser's getting cozy with the Russians is, of course, true Egyptian, we didn't give him the money for the Aswan Dam.
Right.
So he's looking elsewhere for that money.
So I got some recommendations for you. One is a book, and this is published. There's one that's just out a year ago called Suez, Forgotten Invasion. But the one I remember is by Keith Kyle, Suez. It's on Amazon.com. You can get Britain's End of the Empire in the Middle
East. That's correct. That's what they call it.
And have you read Suez by
chance?
No, but I
will. That sounds like a good book to me.
Or if you want to cheat, you can watch the movie starring Tyrone Power, Loretta Young, and Annabella.
Yeah, but that was before this all happened. That was 1953.
Well, again, you won't pass the book report.
That was about Ferdinand de Lesseps, I believe. In fact, that's Tyrone Power married that girl he met in that movie.
Annabella?
Yeah, Annabella. Yeah, he married her.
Why was she just had one name?
She blowed him good.
Armand.
Since you like it so much.
Although
Ty was bisexual, so anybody who would blow him and crap on him, he liked.
It's one of those.
There's
great...
a book about him that you should read about his foibles.
You know, it's a 4-star reviewed movie.
Yeah, Suez. Good movie.
Yeah, I just like the movie poster. It's beautiful. Oh, it's a Zanuck. No wonder.
Daryl F.
They put some money Daryl behind Francis. That stuff. Yep. Okay, then Armand has two other ones. 1991, this date, January 9th, Pete Rose officially banned from baseball.
From the Hall of Fame, yeah. They said they're not going to let him in, which I think is bullshit. Let the guy in.
It'll happen in our lifetime.
Now, I think – you think?
I think it might.
I'll bet you $5 a dozen.
Well, my stance is kind of changing on this. If Bonds and a couple others get to go in, if Bonds, McGuire, the abject steroid cheaters.
How about Strawberry and all these other guys, these drug abusers? People are killing people, right? They're running into cars in the NFL.
I know.
Come on.
I know.
If he had gambled against his team.
But see, there's the thing. Everyone says that. That argument does not hold water.
Well, it holds my water.
No, here's why. In the gambling world, even if you're just placing bets on your team to win, on the day you don't, you're sending a signal to the rest of the... Yes, you are. Go ask your friend the Ocho Man, host of Behind the Eight Ball,
a guy who's never
who loves
a bet in
Pete
his life.
Rose, is a big Cincinnati Reds fan.
All right.
It's a signal. Because what would he? What would?
Well, maybe
what would
Jono
have
in.
Done? What would the Ocho Man have done? Hey, did Pete bet on the Reds today? No? Oh. I'll take the Giants.
It's that kind of spurious logic global warming.
No,
nonsense.
That's not spurious logic. That is a sign. That is a tell.
Maybe he just didn't feel like betting. Or I don't bet every day. What does that mean?
If you bet consistently, and you're always betting consistently on your team to win.
So you think
the days that you it's a problem.
All, who would know this except the bookies? So how would that affect?
Because the bookies talk to other bookies.
Oh.
Especially when you can go to Vegas
and
place
even
a
by
bet.
By taking that, so what? Who's hurt? It's a victimless crime.
The other bettors are hurt.
Ah, to hell with them.
Oh, okay.
It's illegal anyway.
No. No, you could place a bet in Vegas in the 1980s.
I don't buy that one.
That you could place a sports bet in Vegas in the 1980s?
Even if it's true, I am saying it's venial compared to some of these
Here's what's not venial about what Pete did. He lied.
Okay, so what?
He lied.
I lie all the time on this show.
Well,
I never gotten laid in my life.
1998.
See, I admitted it. And I'm gay.
January.
There it is.
You got a big coat on.
Now put Pete in the Hall of Fame.
Look, come on. Right. There was only a couple of players I ever wanted to see as a young kid. Asking my father, hey, who do you want to see at the ballpark this year when other teams come into town? I want to see Pete Rose and the Reds.
Yeah, of course.
I think they had just beaten the Yankees in the centennial, well, not the centennial, but the World Series, the year of the bicentennial, 1976.
Yeah. I think that's the year they renovated Yankees. Was that year?
Yeah, that might have been
Stadium?
It. Yeah. And also 1998.
That might have been the 50th year for Yankee Stadium because it was 26,
it was opened
right?
in 23.
Oh, 23. Okay, well, that's right. Okay.
Yankees won the World Series first year the park opened.
That's right. Yeah,
1912. 1912 Fenway opened. Red Sox won the first year the park opened. One other team has
Cardinals.
Opened the park. There you go. St. Louis Cardinals.
2006.
2000. Right? Yep, 2006. 1998, Karpov. We're going to play a little chess here, Armand.
Yep.
He defeats a gentleman, an Indian.
Viswanathan. I don't know if I'm pronouncing. I don't think.
Anand.
Anand, yeah.
Anand.
And then this is kind of, this isn't really marked down because apparently Karpov was the champ, but then Kasparov beat him, and then Kasparov resigns from the FIDE, gets out of it, so they give Karpov again because he wins some kind of, so technically he wasn't the champ, but I guess, you know, there was some rival, you know,
chess got
federation.
A lot of problems like boxing does
yeah,
with these
right,
things.
Exactly. You're going to have four champs in different weight classes and stuff. But I would like to say about Karpov, and this is, he won the Linares tournament in 1994. This was supposedly the greatest tournament ever by anybody. He won 11
of 13. Well, did Bobby Fischer play in it?
No, but he beat everybody else.
Did Spassky play in it?
Kasparov. No, Kasparov was, I mean, Spassky was done. But the ratings of the players he beat averaged 29.2985.
What's the top rating?
33. Well, they gave him the rating of 29.85, which was the highest.
Okay.
Until Magnus Carlsen, the current champ, got 3,002.
The Dutch guy?
Carlsen, I think, is... I think he's Norwegian.
Oh, okay.
And he's Icelander.
And he's still
from Iceland.
Of course.
Magnus Carlsen. Anyway, but he beat the average of the average ratings, the players he beat, was the highest of any tournament. He won 11 out of 13 games, like unheard of. Two draws. That's kicking ass.
Wait, he didn't lose a game?
He didn't lose a game. Oh, he won 11.
Wow.
So they say that's the greatest tournament.
That's impressive. I don't know. I don't know chess
well,
other than Bobby Fischer. And
I don't know. Yeah.
That's
well, Fischer wouldn't play him. He was supposed to play Fischer in 75.
Did Karpov have a unique gambit or anything?
Nothing named. I'm sure that he's got some variation named after him, but nothing. None of the biggies.
A standard opening move?
I don't know what he played.
You don't examine the games?
No.
Oh, come on. But you're a
fan. In my youth.
All right. Birthdays. Who was born? Who died on this date? 1859. A lady by the name of Carrie Chapman Catt is born on January
the
9th.
Suffragette.
Oh, she's a suffragette.
Yep.
I didn't think you'd like her then.
I didn't say I liked her. I just mentioned her.
She
I thought
born.
You would like her.
No, I do like her. I love suffragettes.
Your omission.
I love them. All right. 1870, Joseph Strauss, the American engineer, and co-designer of the Golden Gate Bridge.
That's correct. We've discussed that at length.
Yeah, Golden Gate Bridge.
About the length of the bridge.
Yeah, well, the construction of it just began a couple days ago in January. 1875, we got Gertrude Vanderbilt Whitney. She's a sculptor, she's a collector, and she founded the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York City. My cousin Sarah was a longtime intern and then worked at the Whitney.
I think she was, wasn't her husband the guy that did Whitney's March? Have you heard of Whitney's March?
No.
It was during the Depression. Yeah, it was on Black Tuesday, I believe. And everybody sell.
Yes.
Everything's going crazy. And Whitney, I think he's a steel guy. What he did was he went and bought U.S. Steel, like a million shares.
A short sell.
No, he bought it. He went.
But the price is plummeting, and he buys.
He buys, but that's not a short sell.
Oh, he didn't.
A short
he
sell.
Didn't.
He wanted it to go down.
Okay.
He thought, to restore confidence.
He wasn't selling and buying back lower.
No, I'm buying.
Good for him.
Didn't help.
Well, it's a nice.
But it's called Whitney's March.
That counts, Armand.
Yeah, nice try. I think that's her husband.
1901, a lady by the name of Vilma Banky is born.
One of my favorites. Not my favorite. But I love the name. The Hungarian Rhapsody, she was known as.
The Hungarian Rhapsody.
She's born in Hungary. Typical. I mean, this is a quintessential silent movie star and her fate. She's big, real big. In fact, she was in a
is
couple
she the
of
proverbial fat lady sings.
No, she's a beautiful woman, and
she's
a beautiful woman, and she was in a couple of she was in The Eagle and The Son of the Sheik, Rudolph Valentino's last movie, and he expressly asked for her to be his co-star.
Wow.
So that's pretty big.
She ever worked with Margaret Dumont?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I don't think so. Her wedding to Rod LaRocque.
Another big star.
Yeah, great name, huh?
Ugh.
Rod LaRocque. And he was matinee idol, and they got married. This is the biggest wedding, probably the silent era. Who gave the bride away? None other than Sam Goldwyn. Who was the best man? Cecil B. DeMille. few hundred or thousand fans were outside the church, rabid fans. And then sound comes, and Vilma's got a really, really heavy Hungarian accent. She's washed up. It's all over. So that's the end of Vilma Banky.
1921, John Sperling, the American businessman, he founded University of Phoenix. Armand loves those.
Love it.
Because those are online universities,
that's
and they're strictly for profit. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
And they work.
You get it. 1928.
Get your books at Amazon. Get on Audible and go to Phoenix for your education.
There you have it.
And you will go places, young man.
1928, Judith Krantz, born on January the 9th. Plenty of her books can be found at Amazon and Audible.com, where if you'd like an audiobook, a Krantz novel might be
a
good one.
Scared the hell out of you, right?
Might be a good one for you to choose
as
an audiobook. So just go to audibletrial.com/thisdayinhistorypodcast and get your free trial. Start it and grab one of those Krantz novels.
Give us a little love. Huh?
1934, Bart Starr, born Alabama quarterback, never really won at Alabama. Did you know that?
Everyone
assumes he was a big success. Alabama was not a big deal in that time.
But
their big deal was coming very soon.
Well, was that before?
It's before Joe Namath. And it's before Brer. Yeah.
Okay, well, there you go.
And then 1935, Gilligan.
First MVP of the Super Bowl. I think both of them, right? The first two?
No, I thought Max McGee got the first one.
Ooh, I don't know about that.
Because Max McGee goes on
the first touchdown.
He goes on the drunken bender the night before
because
he thinks he's nothing but a backup and won't play.
Yeah.
The guy gets hurt in warm-ups.
He's
hungover.
The question is he scored the first touchdown, but I think Bart Starr was the star of the game. I mean,
I think you're probably right.
It's pretty easy because you know me. I have these mnemonics. Bart Starr, star of the game. That's pretty easy.
Oh yeah,
I don't think McGee.
Bart Starr, and let's see what he did on that day. Yep.
Would you mind telling everybody?
Since you're so satisfied with these statistics. He won, and he had a
hell of a game.
Yeah, he had a very good game.
Against the Chiefs. Correct.
Against the Chiefs right. in front of 67,000 in the Los
Angeles. Our friend Hank Stram?
In the Los Angeles Coliseum, yes.
Yeah.
And game's not even sold out.
Right. It was on two networks.
Yes, CBS and NBC both aired it. And there's a lot about Bart Starr for his birthday. But you just walk up and buy a ticket.
Yeah, yeah. And then I don't know how much they were.
$5, I think.
Five? I thought seven, something like that. Yeah. Not much. Yeah.
I think seven for a good seat.
Right.
Yeah.
Get on the field for 10, huh?
Yeah, probably.
Get in the huddle for 12.
For right. 1935, Bob Denver's
interesting.
Born.
Interesting. All right. What's Gilligan's first name?
I have no idea.
Willie? Willie Gilligan.
Oh, God. 1935, also on the same date, Dick Enberg born.
He wrote a good book. I read his book.
Oh, my.
Yeah, good
now,
book.
Now, George Takei has now got the Oh, My deal, but for years, Enberg. That was a great, just short, simple catchphrase and for highlights.
Yeah, I like Dick Enberg.
1941, Joan Baez born. 1944,
greatest guitarist,
Jimmy Page.
Greatest rock guitarist of all time, hands down. Don't even argue. Jimmy Page.
No argument for
me. And he did the music for Death Wish 2, which is why it's so cool. Yeah, listen to that music of that movie. That's Jimmy going.
That's a nice.
Psychedelic,
oh,
man.
Very cool. Okay.
Yeah.
1951, Crystal Gayle born.
Now, that's what's her name's sister?
You ever think she cut her hair?
I don't know. I'm not.
She's a country singer.
Right. She's somebody's sister, right?
And she might be. I don't know. You're asking me about country music?
I don't know.
Come on now. But when I was little, she had never cut her hair in her life, and it was already getting almost down to her knees.
Okay.
And I don't know that she cut it to this day.
Rapunzel,
1955,
huh?
J.K. Simmons born. Yeah, now, he's a fine
actor.
Made
his bones in insurance commercials.
Yeah, the Farmers.
Yeah.
And then, I got to tell you, one of the great character actors, man.
I haven't seen that movie, Whiplash. That's the one.
I haven't seen it yet either.
Yeah, I read the script.
We have two events that occur on January the 9th. That Armand and I feel probably affect the world we live in today the most.
Right.
And the first one is going to give Armand major fits, probably heart palpitations, and might cause a seizure.
All right.
But on this date, an introduction was made by the British Prime Minister, William Pitt,
the younger, that's right.
And what he did is introduced the income tax. A tax of 2 shillings to the pound to raise funds for Great Britain's war against Napoleon.
Yeah, that's what we always want to do. We want to fight as many wars as we can so we can tax people to pay for it. That's what kings do. That's what prime ministers like Pitt do. And his boy, Henry Beek, I think is the guy who came up with this brilliant idea, his finance minister or whatever the hell his name, his title was. Anyway, a couple things about Pitt. He was the youngest prime minister, if you ever asked that. Teddy Roosevelt, of course, our youngest president.
President, okay. And Pitt's youngest youngest PM.
And
okay.
It's easy to remember, Pitt the Younger.
Pitt the Younger.
There you go. He's 24 years old.
Good grief.
So, yeah, all the stupidity of youth right there. And he was a three-bottle man. Like to drink his port wine. Three bottles a day. So he was probably drunk when he came up with this idea. So anyway, he was replaced by the next prime minister, who's I think Henry Addington, repealed these opprobrious laws.
Right.
Good for him, right? There's a treaty of Amiens, Treaty of Amiens with Napoleon.
Yes, ends the war. Right? So we should be able to end the tax, right?
Okay. Yeah, well, they start up again. More war, more tax, same old crap. Until Waterloo, then, of course, he repeals the tax again. But we haven't heard the last of the income tax, of course.
No, and then it, of course, gets introduced in the U.S.
Boy.
About 100 years later. About
115
years later.
Yeah, first during the Civil War and then, of course, the 13th Amendment.
So we all pay it.
Scourge.
We all pay it, right? It's
not
universal.
What's her name? Tammy Faye Baker? Who's the one that – is that Tammy Faye? Who's the one – taxes are for the little people?
That could have been Tammy Faye. It sounds like something like Tammy Faye.
Yeah.
Well, of course, unless you're L. Ron Hubbard, I don't think he paid it either.
Well, little Timmy Geithner didn't pay his.
No, he didn't.
He's our Treasury Secretary.
Well, he would know.
A lot of people
do. What would our purchasing power be like without an income tax?
I'd like to find out.
I know, but all things adjust. So the market would adjust
in
terms of purchasing power.
No, because that's not one of the laws of economics.
It's not?
No. If you devalue the dollar, the currency or whatever, you keep printing, then you have inflation. But by not taxing, that doesn't increase the money supply. Because, as Milton Friedman
says, inflation
is at all times and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. And there's no such thing as a free lunch.
No, absolutely true.
Okay.
No such thing as a free lunch.
Talking.
The monetary supply, though, right. The monetary supply, if you took away income tax, doesn't increase. But just more income in the hands of consumers.
Yeah, it's good.
Hypothetically, more disposable income.
Correct.
With more disposable income available, what do the economists say about inflation then rising?
I don't think that has anything to do with it. I don't think – as long as inflation is, again, monetary, but productivity, it's probably better for wages. You know, you're going to get more. Your wages would go up, I think, because if you take the corporate tax away too, but you give people more money to buy. That's
what's the government supposed to run off then?
Who cares? What do we need the government for? Listen, all the government's supposed to do is pave the roads and defend us, and they don't do either very well.
Well, that costs something.
Okay, no, they don't. Two-thirds of the budget goes to Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. In the military. But the military even is not that much, but okay. Cut the military. Fine. Cut them all.
They've got to pay for the electric bill somehow.
All right. Yeah, but those are all state issues. What does the federal government need your taxes for? What is the federal government?
That's why we are talking about a federal income tax. I'm not talking about a state tax, which are relatively
pay for the common defense. Yeah. Right? What else do you want the federal government to do?
Pave my interstates?
Well, come on. Let the states do that. The states can't pave their own roads? Maybe a bridge between Illinois and Missouri.
So transit states that have trucks driving through them
and paying $4,000 a year in taxes for that privilege. Where do you think that money goes? It doesn't go to pave the roads. It goes for everything. Why do you pay 50 cents a gallon of your taxes? Every gallon
I don't
pay
50 cents.
Yes, you do. Federal tax.
Live in Missouri.
No, that's not. It's federal. It's not state. The feds charge that. Sure. Look it up.
I will. Got a hybrid car, though, just to piss you off. I get like 43 per gallon. It's beautiful.
I get 40-something.
You do?
Oh, sure.
Good for
Hyundai.
You.
Are you kidding?
Good for you.
Hey, listen,
see, you do love the environment.
I'm a good steward of the environment.
You
I just
do
don't
love
believe in
the
global warming.
All right.
I don't
polluting. The next one I have.
I don't burn dung.
Well, that's okay.
Well, sometimes. Sometimes I chew a little, but I don't burn it. Okay.
In 2007.
Right. What are we on? I forgot we're on now.
We're on the very last one. Look down at your page.
Oh. All right. Oh, we're still on the events.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is the other event that I think affects the world we live in today.
Well, okay. You got one here. Yeah.
Again, I love communication. Armand does not. But Steve Jobs, He introduces the original iPhone at a Macworld keynote in San Francisco, California.
I gotta read that book on him, damn it.
You do.
Have you got it?
Yes, I do. My son gave it to me for Christmas a year ago or 2 years ago.
I got to get it up for my Kindle.
Mm-hmm.
Was it Jacobson? Did he write
mm-hmm.
it? Okay.
Walter Jacobson, fine biographer. Yeah. And he's written, matter of fact, let me look Jacobson up for a second.
Now, Jobs apparently wasn't a real nice guy.
No, of course not.
Like, what was his, the turtleneck sweater? And that, was it the black sweater?
Black turtleneck, right, sort of a mock turtleneck, yeah. Even not even a really full turtleneck.
Now, this guy, I mean, here again, I don't care what kind of guy you think he is or what kind of jerk he was. This is a guy, these are the kind of guys that make our country great. Not politicians, not tax and spend bureaucrats, guys like Steve Jobs. I mean, this guy, look what he's done for us. Look what he's done for your life and mine.
Well, again,
there you go.
The iPhone.
That's innovation.
I mean, not that he invented all the tech or anything. He did not.
No, but that's but not he, what he was. I mean,
he realized just how important it was to sort of
when Apple kicked
get
him
that
out,
intuitive.
Right. He was like Oppenheimer kind of. Oppenheimer was not the greatest physicist of all time. Far from it. But he knew organization. He knew how to get people to work for him. He was a guy that was an inspiration. And he inspired genius. And apparently that's what this Jobs guy. Plus, this guy had an intimate, almost uncanny sense of what the public wanted, apparently. Because since he's been gone, I mean, Tim Cook's competent, but he's no Steve Jobs. That's all I got to say about that. And I don't think I'd buy the stock if I were
you. Walter Isaacson is the author of that book.
Of course.
Okay, Jacobson. Walter Isaacson. And he's also, I tell you, if you haven't read this one, Armand, this is the first book I read by Walter Isaacson. And go and get this on Amazon or Audible.com. His biography of Einstein, which is written for sort of the general populace.
Yeah.
He does a wonderful job breaking down and explaining to the novice the general theory of relativity in that book.
I'm not a novice.
You're not a novice. You probably wouldn't appreciate it. It'd be like light skimming for you. And he also did a book, which I very much enjoyed as well, about Benjamin Franklin and American life.
Okay.
And it goes into detail about Franklin in Paris.
Oh, well, that'd be fun.
And there's a lot of dalliances in Paris.
Ben was great.
Yeah.
Have you ever read his essay on Fart Proudly?
Yeah.
It was good.
Also,
Finding a Mistress.
He probably should have done an essay on how to bathe with older French women. He apparently was good at that.
Oh, man, he was great.
Okay, who died on the – what would you vote for, by the way? It's got to be income tax, right?
Damn it.
As much as I love my iPhone, it's the income tax that has changed the world
sickening.
We live in.
Yeah, it sure has.
And, you know, William.
Drop dead, Pitt.
Pitt, the younger.
Yeah, the younger. Yeah, we'll give the old man a pass. Oh, yeah. A little contraception would have helped. Come on, you British.
On this date, January the 9th.
Here's a guy that's kind of full of shit.
In the year 13.
I think
he is too.
Okay.
Marco Polo, the merchant and the explorer, the Italian, he passes away.
And exaggerator, apparently. Yeah. But although, you know, some of the things he knew, apparently you couldn't know without being. Some people question whether he even went to China at all, whether he was even there.
Look, you just meet a bunch of guys on the road who tell you some things.
Yeah, but where'd he get the spaghetti?
Oh.
Or is that just a myth, too?
I think that's a myth.
Yeah,
I think that's a myth.
Back. All right.
1936, John Gilbert passes away.
Yeah, one of my favorite silent film actors.
You love the silence.
He was in the, this guy was something else. Oh, this guy's got a great story, too. You think Vilma Bankey's a good one?
No, I don't.
John Gilbert.
But,
okay, get a load of this. So John Gilbert is the highest paid silent actor, $250,000 a film.
What?
In the 20s. Right. Okay. So that's big money.
Wait, so he's making twice what Babe Ruth is making.
Oh, yeah. He's putting him to shame. $250,000 a movie. Okay. So John Gilbert is at MGM, but he and Louis B. Mayer can't stand each other. They really can't stand each other because Mayer thought he was over. Just couldn't see what was so great about him. He was kind of a pain in the ass about his scripts, fancied himself a writer. And he wasn't bad, actually. Wrote a couple of the movies he was in, and they're not bad.
Let me ask you something about MGM.
Uh-huh.
You got Louis Mayer.
Yeah.
Got Samuel Goldwyn.
Right. Metro was the.
What was Metro?
Metro was a film studio.
Just a film studio.
They all merged.
And they all
merged.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
In 1924. So Gilbert's right there, at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess, no, it was 1925, because I think their silver anniversary was 1950. So that makes sense. So anyway, Gilbert's the highest paid actor. And of course, because all his movies make money, most of them. So he starts, he stars with Greta Garbo, and they fall in love. Okay. So. Gilbert.
Garbo
Jack,
had the
Jack.
Effect, didn't she?
Yeah, I want to be alone. So anyway, Jack kind of wants to, you know, hey, what the hell? He's an honorable guy. He wants to get married.
Yeah.
Now, the myth, now here again, this could be mythical too, but it's been corroborated, apparently, a couple of books I've read on Gilbert. He's at the wedding, and it's supposed to be a double wedding between him and King Vidor, who is the director of The Big Parade, the second highest grossing silent film of all time, I think behind King of Kings.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a big hit, real big hit.
Well, first of all, you had a name like King Vidor.
King Vidor, great name for a director.
We're talking about you got that right.
Apposite names, that's mm-hmm. a great name. In fact, I think Birth of a Nation was obviously the highest.
Yeah.
Okay, that's number one. But this is the highest grossing film of the 20s is The Big Parade.
Wow.
With John Gilbert. So anyway, Vidor and his bride, Eleanor Broadman, an actress who's long, you know.
Forgotten.
Yeah, just fluttered into oblivion.
All right.
Anyway, they get married. Greta, where's Greta? Greta didn't show up.
She stiffed him?
Yeah, Greta got some nerves. She wanted to be alone. Didn't go to the wedding. There he is, poor Jack at the altar. And, Louis B. Mayer had a kind of a checkered sense of humor a little bit. And he said something to the effect that, you know, he was a fag or something, whatever. Made a joke. And Jack Gilbert attacks him.
Nice.
Yeah. Starts throwing punches, knocks him down. So, yeah. So you got Louis B. Mayer pissed off, though. That's not a good idea when you work at MGM.
Might as well piss off Al Capone in that
so
era.
It's not a good idea, right? So, okay, sound comes. Talkie's coming. Apparently, Gilbert had a nice, silky, well, deep, resonating voice, like mine. And so Louis B. Mayer talks to the sound guy. And on
says,
his first,
screw it up.
Yeah. Give him that kind of voice. And that's what he did. And in fact, they called it gelding his voice. They gelded his voice. Yeah. You know what gelding means.
So I gave a toast once, my best friend's wedding. We had taken him to the Kentucky Derby. I forget the year. I think 2003. And we take him to the Derby. He wins his bet on the Derby race.
Yeah. Because
they have a bunch of races.
Sure.
Sure.
It's like the eighth,
I'm going to say it's the eighth, ninth race, right? And he wins. And during the toast, I said, you know, and his wife is Jennifer. I said, Jennifer, we had a great bachelor party. And we went down to the Derby, and it was a great time. And your husband, who never wins anything, won. He won. That was spectacular.
Good omen. Yes.
It's a great omen. Well, I don't know if it's such a good omen. He had the winning bet on, I think the horse's name is Giacomo.
Oh, Giacomo, sure.
Do you remember that one?
Yeah, I remember that one. Yeah, that's
and
the winner.
I said, I just hope it's not a bad sign that Giacomo was a gelding.
Ooh.
I look out at the crowd, and I mean crickets, except for
that's
one guy.
Joke.
Except for one guy who was just pounding the table laughing.
Yes.
I was like, there's my guy.
Gelding.
That's a great toast.
All right, that's not bad. It's not bad.
It's a great one.
Yeah, I don't know why it fell so flat. Anyway, that was
because no one knew what gelding meant.
Oh, okay.
Bunch of non-horse
racing
people.
That was the end of his career, unfortunately. He started out as usual. He was always a heavy drinker, probably another three-bottle man.
Who wasn't?
Had a heart attack, drops dead in 1936. I think he was, 34, 35 years old. Not very old. 37.
Not very old.
That was it.
Okay, also, the last one for today. Passed away on this day.
Oh, not quite. I told you I had one.
You had one more. I got 2013.
No, I thought we were going to do 1989.
Oh, I forgot. Yeah, there he is. 1989, great ball player. I never got to meet this guy.
Yeah, it's too bad.
But great ball player, hell of a player, hell of a hitter. The American player, New York Giants, first base, Bill Terry. He would also be a manager.
Answer to a trivia question, of
1989
course.
1989 passes away on January the 9th.
Last National Leaguer to hit 400. In 1930, if you can believe that. Yep. So he was the last National Leaguer to hit 400.
Yeah, he's the last National Leaguer to hit 400. The last National Leaguer to win a Triple Crown is Joe Medwick in 1937.
Right?
Yeah, that's correct. The last National Leaguer to win, or the last American Leaguer to hit 400 is Ted Williams in 41.
Yeah.
Nope, that's not true anymore. The Detroit.
The Triple Crown you're talking
about? Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
He won in 48, too. He won twice. Ted Williams did. So that wouldn't have been right anyway. Carl Yastrzemski was 1967 when he tied for the highest batting average with 301.
301.
So technically,
no,
he
but
was
I'm saying,
the answer, too.
The last American League Triple Crowner
right,
just happened
saying.
A couple years ago.
Correct. But even then, it was before. That was Yastrzemski in 67 before. What's his name? With Cabrera?
Cabrera.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
So anyway, but Bill Terry, hell of a player. Player manager, 1933, World Series champ.
Here's the thing. The New York Yankees, as good as they were, Everyone thinks Babe Ruth won the World Series every year. It's not true. In his time with the Yankees from
27 and 28, right?
He won in 27. They beat the Pirates. Right. They win in 28.
Cardinals.
They also win in 32 over the Cubs. That's his called shot.
Called shot so
and
32.
He wins one more. He went only won four times.
Yeah, 27, 28, 32. What did they? Not 33. Was it 30?
It's not 34. That was Cardinals. Because the Cardinals.
35? Not 35 either. When did he win the other one? He was already gone by then.
1923, the first year of Yankee Stadium.
Oh, okay, right. That's
so
right.
23, okay, before, 27, yeah. 28, 32.
Right. The House of Ruth built. Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
But the guys who I cleaned up are Gehrig and DiMaggio,
well,
and
Berra.
Then Yogi Berra's got 14.
Yeah, they're the guys that, right.
14.
Well, they won like four in a row, then five in a row. And yeah.
So it's Bill Terry's New York Giants.
Yeah, 1933.
That are completely overshadowed because of Ruth. But if you ask, and again, we do the show near St. Louis, the old Cardinal fans, when you say, well, what was the rivalry with the Cubs like? They go, wasn't a rivalry. The Cardinals' big rival in those days was the New York Giants.
I don't know, the Dodgers too, right?
And Brooklyn.
Yeah.
But Brooklyn had their ups and downs until they kind of got on a roll.
The Giants still have the most losses in the World Series.
Oh, I
definitely
think so, too.
Definitely National League, probably the American, too.
Yeah, because the Giants and the Dogers, they both kept catching the Yankees in that time period.
Maybe Brooklyn, but boy, Brooklyn got wiped out.
It took them a lot of chance. It was, you know.
Well, the Giants have the most pennants, I think. They don't have.
It depends on how you count pennants.
Well,
I don't count pennants pre 1901.
What I think they have more than the Cardinals.
Yeah, they do because they count them all the way back to 1876 in the National League. Yes,
no, I don't. I think it's before then, though.
What?
I mean, after that. I think it's 20th century and beyond.
No. Okay, after 1901, the Cardinals are your winningest pennant team in the National League.
I don't think so.
But if you include prior to, it's the Dodgers and the Giants both have them.
Okay, I'm gonna check.
I mean, they really won a lot.
Right.
You gotta remember, the Cardinals did nothing.
Right.
Until
like 18
almost
years in a row, they didn't win anything. It's
almost 19.
To
no, but the record was okay,
yeah.
I mean. But they really stunk from like 1901 all the way up into the 20s.
26, yeah.
And then Branch Rickey arrives, they get it figured out.
Well, then, of course, there's Brooklyn Robins, too, and all that.
There were the Robins. Weren't even the Dodgers back then.
The Giants,
then.
I think, won a few pennants. And
always. Okay. Always.
And then my last one, of course,
yeah,
I
you
added,
have one more.
2013. James M.
Buchanan.
Right. Nobel Prize winner in economics for constitutional economics. Member of the Mont Pelerin Society, which we love. Luminaries such as Hayek and Milton Friedman, of course, were in
Uncle
that.
Uncle Milty.
Yep. And this guy, they had the same teacher, Frank Knight. Frank, if you ask Uncle Milton, who influenced
Uncle Milton.
Him.
That's what my
Uncle Milton.
Ever told
Frank
you this?
Knight.
My economics professor, St. Louis University. Leroy Grossman.
Okay, that's a good name for
you. It's a great name.
Yeah, of course.
Great name. He would get up and just wax poetic about Uncle Milty.
Good for him.
And it took me a day or two to figure out that he was talking about someone other than Milton Berle.
Yeah, it's not someone who didn't wear a dress. Although, you know, I don't think his dick was as big as Milton Berle's.
Have you ever heard that one?
There's the legend. The fun.
Okay, it's the Jackie Gleason. Do you know the story?
Yeah, right. They're at the urinal.
No. I heard that they're at the table. This is the way I've heard it. I've heard they're at a table, and someone is big dicking.
Right, challenges
Uncle
Milton Berle. Yeah,
and Milty's getting pissed off.
Right,
and he's
Jackie
ready.
Says,
he's ready to get it out and lay it on the table. And Jackie Gleason, the great one, says, "Just show him enough to win."
Yeah, just take out enough to win. That was it. That's a famous story.
Scenes of things that I would have liked to have been there for.
That's a good one.
That's one of them.
Jackie Gleason.
Show them enough to win.
Just take out enough to win. All right. But anyway, James M. Buchanan, not to be confused with either of those guys.
That's who we're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, Austrian. Yeah. Called himself a quasi-Austrian.
What made Austrians such good economics?
But anybody
guys, did they just
Frank
catch
Knight,
the right teacher
University
at the right
of Chicago.
Time?
Well, I guess he just didn't agree with everything they say about booms and busts.
Yeah.
You know, economists, they don't agree on anything. But here's a couple of quotes from him that I like. I reject that any organic conception of the state as superior in wisdom
to the
individual who are its members.
Which is the market, right? He's referring to the market.
Yeah, we're talking about the individual here.
No, but the individuals make up the market.
All right, here's one. Economics is the study of the whole system of exchange relationships. Politics is a study of the whole system of coercive or potentially coercive relationships.
I absolutely agree with that.
Of course. Brilliant man.
I absolutely
miss him.
They will tell, politicians would say politics is the art of the possible.
Yeah.
The majority whip of any bicameral body anywhere anywhere in the world will tell you that Mr. Buchanan's definition is correct.
Right. Coercion. That's all it is. Income tax. You think Pitt the Younger didn't? Do you think he just asked for money? Please help us fight a war.
Right.
Coercion.
All right. That'll do it. We are through. January 9th, in the books.
How come we don't charge for this show, by the way?
We might.
Let's coerce somebody to pay us.
Yeah, if we can, we should.
All right, send money in.
Well, for producer Brian Kroc, for my co-host Armin Kachigian, I'm Tony Hubert. Enjoy the rest of your day. And when January 9th rolls around, when January 10th rolls around, we'll be here to tell you about it right here on lineupmedia.fm.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.